Hi, this is Doug with the Fair Recovery Movement with another group coaching session. For this session that was recorded earlier, we are very pleased to have Robert T. Muller, PhD. Dr. Muller, trained at Harvard, was on faculty at the University of Massachusetts and is currently at York University in Toronto. He is a fellow of the International Society for the Study of Trauma and Dissociation for his work on trauma treatment. And his bestseller, Trauma and the Avoidant Client, has been translated widely and won the 2011 ISSTD Award for the year's best written work on trauma. As lead investigator on several multi-site programs to treat interpersonal trauma, Dr. Muller has lectured internationally and has been keynote speaker at mental health conferences in New Zealand and Canada. He also founded an online magazine called the Trauma and Mental Health Report that is now visited by over 100,000 readers a year. With over 25 years in the field, he practices in Toronto, Canada. So without further ado, please enjoy this audio with Sarah P. and Dr. Robert T. Muller.
So today's session is about PTSD, and we will be talking about PTSD and how it relates to infidelity. Rob Muller joins us today. He has a PhD in clinical psychology from Harvard University. And he's also the best-selling author of a book called Trauma and the Avoidant Client, Attachment-Based Strategies for Healing. Of course, you should have already seen an email from Doug that contains more about Rob, his blog sites, and about his book. Thanks again for joining me today, Rob, and welcome. Is there anything that you'd like to say before we got started today?
Hello, everybody.
Yeah, hi.
Nothing specific.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Awesome. How are you?
Good. So everything's well today.
Good.
Excellent. And with you too, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm excited about your book. I've been reading it, and it is awesome because I did not realize how many people have avoidant attachment. And that mm-hmm. can be the problem that leads them into psychotherapy. But it may not be immediately seen because these people can also present as very self-reliant people mm-hmm. who are able to take care of themselves and get it done when nobody else gets it done. And so that was really interesting for me to read about. So great book for anybody who would like to read more about that.
Thank you.
So,
appreciate
yeah. So our first question is actually about avoidant attachment disorder. So can you tell me why people with avoidant attachment disorder are sometimes prone to affairs and why these same people tend to sweep the affair under the rug after the partner finds out?
Yeah, for sure. So it might be a little bit helpful for me to talk just before kind of launching into what avoidant attachment is. Mm-hmm. To give a little bit of a quick kind of background on attachment in general and some of the different patterns of attachment. And this is important because as we think about some of the other issues around affairs, around trauma, around so many different issues, understanding how attachment works will be helpful. So one thing to bear in mind is that attachment theory is an idea that really speaks to the question of how do people maintain closeness and proximity in relationships during times of threat or loss or danger. And a psychiatrist by the name of John Bowlby in the 1950s and 60s, studied children who were abandoned, children who were in orphanages, and then also later psychologists studied young children, you know, when they were separated from their parents, and then adults who had losses or traumas, and they found that there are these different very stable patterns of attachment, and that these attachment patterns seem to really hold throughout the lifespan. Now, of course, with good relationships later on in life, with psychotherapy, people can improve in their attachment patterns. They can go from what's called an insecure attachment pattern to a secure one. But without any treatment or without, you know, all of the things being equal, these patterns of attachment tend to be quite stable. And so avoidant attachment pattern is one of the four main categories of attachment. Secure attachment is the one that probably about 60% of the population or more have. And secure doesn't mean everything's perfect and happy-go-lucky. It just simply means that the person has a general sense that when they, you know, that in relationships, people will be generally reliable, that they can generally trust people. They have a basic sense of people in the world as being okay. They don't feel frightened of relationships. They generally have a general sense of stability, and they're generally flexible in how they relate to others. People who have an avoidant attachment pattern, that is one of the insecure patterns. And what you see there very often are people who've grown up in homes where there's a lot of criticism, where there's a sense of emotions are dangerous, emotions are useless. You know, you should have a stiff upper lip. You should, you know, if something bad happens to you, don't be a crybaby. That kind of idea. So people who grew up in homes where there's a real sense that vulnerable feelings are not okay, they very often will learn that and transmit that to their own children, and they often will also have trouble in love relationships, in romantic relationships. They often will come across as very independent. They'll if their partner expresses a lot of emotional need, then they will view them as weak. And so it's an insecure pattern because they really fall apart when vulnerable things happen to them. So people who have an avoidant attachment pattern will really struggle during times like during losses or during, you know, if their child is ill, or, you know, when their attachment system is activated, when something happens to kind of activate feelings of separation and loss, they will really struggle with feelings. And there are other insecure attachment patterns as well. You know, one of the other insecure attachment patterns is what's called preoccupied attachment, where people tend to become very, very preoccupied with anger and hurt, you know, like with hurts, prior hurts in relationships, and they will often become very angry and will have trouble really calming down. Their emotions are kind of volatile, and there are other patterns as well. So why are they prone to affairs? Well, it's not so much that they're necessarily more prone, people with an avoidant attachment pattern, more prone to having affairs. It's more that when affairs happen, they cut off emotions. And so when there's difficulty in their relationships, in the relationship with their partner, they will turn away from emotion and maybe may turn to others, may turn to sexual addictions, may turn to gambling addictions, may turn to substance use, may turn to workaholism. They'll turn away from their feelings, may isolate themselves. And so this can be really damaging to relationships, right?
Mm-hmm.
One thing to think about with the avoidant attachment pattern is that it isn't the same thing as narcissism. Sometimes people think of people who have an avoidant attachment as being kind of arrogant and narcissistic and self-indulgent and that sort of thing. That's not necessarily true. There are people who have avoidant attachment who are narcissistic. That is, you know, there are. But they're not the same thing. And you can have people who have avoidant attachment who are, frankly, lovely people. You know, they're friendly and gregarious and kind, but when it gets personal, that's when they have difficulty. So they may, you know, they may be great in social situations, you know, joke around and be friendly and warm. You know, they may actually even be very generous with others, you know, taking care of other people, kind of chronic caretakers of others. It's that they themselves struggle with being vulnerable to others. And so when feelings are difficult, when there's conflict in relationships, they will turn away from the conflict, run away from difficult feelings. And that's, of course, a problem. And so they may turn to affairs. They may turn to other kinds of addictions. They may turn to any things that make them feel better in order not to have to struggle with the conflict of a challenging relationship. And so that's where they get themselves into a lot of trouble. And their partners also get into trouble because of it.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, because the partner does what exactly in reaction to this? What would that look like?
Yeah, it's confusing. It can be really confusing to people, you know, like especially when, you know, when you know, you're feeling, you know, you're when you feel like, so if your partner has an avoidant attachment pattern and you're needing closeness and you turn to the person that you want to turn to for closeness and it's that very closeness that they shun, that can be both confusing and distressing and can be very challenging. And I sometimes see couples where there's this kind of one person is kind of pursuing the other and sort of, you know, I want to be closer to you kind of thing. And the other person, and that's the very thing that turns them away. And that's a real problem in relationships. I mean, that's, you know, they often do need couples therapy at to manage that kind of imbalance.
You know, this actually reminds me of a French proverb that says, in all relationships, there is one who kisses and one who is kissed. So it hints at that imbalance.
Wow. Okay.
Have you heard that one?
I have not. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's really interesting.
It might be a cultural thing. I lived there for 3 years, and that's my second language.
Oh.
But, yeah, that's a common proverb in France where they almost expect that power imbalance where one is always pursuing and the other one is pursued.
And, you know, what you see this, and I think in many relationships, you know, very rare is it that the relationships are exactly balanced, even in very healthy relationships. But it's kind of a question of, you know, on balance, is there some ability for both people to be able to work through conflict? And, you know, when you have someone who's really got an avoidant attachment pattern, it's so frustrating because, you know, one person is like, okay, you know, I don't want to go to sleep angry. I'm angry at you. And the other one is like, I need to go to sleep. I need to get out. I need space. I can't deal with this right now. And sometimes, you know, with couples I work with them, you know, the person who's, you know, coping with or living with a person who has an avoidant attachment pattern, I may need to work with her or him to say, you know, he's not saying to you that he, you know, doesn't want to talk about it. It's more just he can't do it right away. He needs or she needs a break and needs to take that walk for an hour. Let them take the walk. But then it also means with the other person, take the walk, but then you got to actually eventually talk about it. You can't just forget about it kind of thing. So kind of finding that balance with couples can be really challenging in couples work.
So in the case of an affair, it might seem like if somebody does have avoidant attachment, it might seem to the person who is the betrayed spouse that the cheating spouse wants to sweep the whole thing under the rug.
Right.
They want, right? And so that actually is a huge source of anger for the betrayed spouse. That's what I've seen personally.
Exactly. Exactly. I agree.
How do you tell if somebody is a rug sweeper where they just don't want to deal with it because they don't want to be ashamed, or if somebody has avoidant attachment disorder, or if it's a combination of both, or maybe it's a narcissist who doesn't have insight into doing something wrong, or they're so wounded within themselves that they can't be there for somebody else.
I mean, there are so many different flavors of this, and I agree. I mean, I guess the thing is, what's their characteristic lifelong pattern of relationships? I mean, people who really have this avoidant attachment pattern struggle in vulnerable relationships, and you know, we see this with their children as well. So it's not just kind of in the relationship with a partner. This is also the kind of individual whose children will feel emotionally hungry. There's a sort of a sense of mom or dad being a little bit of a closed off box that you can't quite get into, and it's really hard for children to feel that kind of sense of distance. You see the same pattern in across the person's relationships. But then, of course, there are people like you said, like it's not necessarily, you know, maybe that this is just not a great relationship, and the person doesn't really want to open up to this particular person, and then they may have had other relationships, or they may have a much better relationship with their children, or they may have had other relationships where they were able to feel much closer. So it's kind of the avoidant attachment pattern isn't just a kind of a one-off kind of thing. It's really a lifelong pattern that people have. It's often very frustrating for friends. You know, friends will often say, you know, you don't tell me very much about you. Like I don't, you know, I you're hard to read, you know, and that kind of thing. And so there's, it's not just a one-off. It's something that we see across close relationships, this difficulty.
And this is a little bit of a side question relating to it. It was something that you mentioned earlier about attachment styles being able to switch throughout a lifetime. For example, here's a scenario. I believe that prior to having gone through being the betrayed partner in an affair, and it ended so badly where there were financial repercussions for me, very real financial repercussions. I believe before that I was securely attached. But after that, I feel very much as if my attachment style switched because I was no longer open. I was no longer trusting. I was always looking behind my back. It seemed to change something fundamentally within me. And is that possible when an affair happens?
Well,
is that something that you see?
Well, it's interesting what you're talking about. I mean, it sounds like you were burned, or you were really hurt very badly in this relationship, and I've experienced hurtful relationships as well. I mean, some relationships can be traumatic, and traumatic events do have effects on us. And I can't speak to what your attachment style was before, but I think it does happen that people sort of, when they've sort of lived in some ways kind of an okay life, and then experiences happen that they really feel or experience as traumatic, that they find that they've been changed, and they find that their way of trusting others is different. They feel much more attentive to betrayal. They're more mistrustful in a sense, more anxious, because there's the possibility of being hurt again. So yeah, I mean this can happen. I mean, I think I've seen it more in the other direction, in the sense of like working with people in therapy who have an insecure attachment, and seeing over time that they're able to reach a point where they're what's called in the business earned secure. So this is someone who has been through really difficult, painful experiences, but through a process of actively using relationships around them, therapy, active work on themselves, taking emotional risks, you know, calculated emotional risks, thoughtful emotional risks, that they're able to begin to open up again and trust again when they have, you know, when they've been sort of, you know, had reparative experiences, kind of corrective emotional experiences, you know, later experiences in life, either with a therapist or with other good relationships, that in a sense correct some of the pain that they've been through, and they sort of become more secure in the way that they view relationships. So these attachment patterns can shift. Both by positive relational experiences and by really, you know, traumatic negative ones.
But Rob, that's actually great news, because even if somebody does have a setback, it's been demonstrated that the right kind of therapy can actually help them, it sounds like.
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah. I am a therapist. I'm a psychologist. I'm a big believer in therapy. I've been working with people for 20 years, and people get better. I mean, the old adage is true. You know, only if they want to change. I mean, in a sense, you know, you can say everybody wants to change, but not everybody's really ready to take the kind of, in many ways, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't for many people. So they're willing to say, I want to change, but really, actually, they're scared of it. And so they're not really truly ready for change. But for people who are sort of at a point where they, you know, they want to shift how they have dealt with people, then therapy can be helpful.
Great. And let's talk a little bit about PTSD and why some people are more prone to developing PTSD after traumatic experiences than others. And of course, then do some people develop PTSD after their partner's affair, and why?
Sure, yeah. So there are two kind of psychology concepts, you know, in clinical psychology that are really important here. One is risk and one is resilience. And I'll just briefly talk about risk, and I'll say that there were some really interesting studies that were done through the 90s that looked at how risk factors end up leading you to be more likely to develop mental health problems. So the best known of these studies is the ACEs study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study, and that was kind of a partnership with Kaiser, who is I think it's an HMO, and the Center for Disease Control, and they studied something like 17,000, I mean, a lot of people, looking at their childhood experiences of physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, mental illness of the parent, other kinds of risk, you know, alcoholism in the home, witnessing domestic violence, witnessing violent crime. I mean, these are risk factors. And what they found is that these risk factors really add up. The more risk factors you have, the more likely you are to develop some kind of mental health problem, including PTSD. And in my study, I did a study at Michigan State University where I did some graduate work, and there similar findings, you know, abuse from mothers and abuse from fathers added up. You know, the more abuse you had, the higher your risk for developing aggressive behaviors, for developing other kinds of mental health problems as well. And then another really interesting area of research was with Vietnam vets. That was through the 70s and 80s. They found that people who went to Vietnam and who developed PTSD, the ones, you know, people had very similar experiences. You know, they all witnessed horrible war and other kinds of very, very adverse events. But the ones who were most likely to develop PTSD were people who also had childhood abuse. So these risk factors add up through our lives and make it more likely that we're going to actually end up with mental health problems. So that's one set of research, and that is true. The risk factor research is correct, and it is true. But at the same time, this whole other area of research, which is resilience research, what resilience research focuses on is how different people interpret or experience the same experiences differently. And so you can have three kids in one family, you know, all of whom experienced alcohol in the home, let's say, you know, the alcoholism of a parent. One kid ends up with an alcohol problem. The other is against alcohol. The third has, you know, something in between, or one has various kinds of mental health problems, the other doesn't. And so we see that different people can be resilient despite the same adverse events. And so why do we have both? These sound like contradictory things, but what we have to remember is that all this research is about probabilities. If you have the more risk factors you have, different kinds of adverse, you know, abusive experiences in your early life and then traumatic events later in life, it raises the likelihood. It's all about risk and probability. It raises the likelihood of a mental health problem. But different people interpret those same events differently. And some people, you know, it's interesting, most people who've gone through violent crime don't actually have PTSD. It's a minority who develop PTSD. And so different people get affected by the same events differently. Why are some people more likely to develop PTSD? Because, you know, some people are resilient and others are less resilient. Now, what makes people more or less resilient becomes the, you know, $25,000 question. And I think the biggest factor in resilience research is how do you use your relationships? There were some longitudinal studies, that beautifully done studies that looked at which people who, despite high risk, end up resilient, the ones who are able to turn to others in times of distress and let them in, and the ones who are able to give support to others. So not just receiving support and relationship closeness, but also providing it is equally important. And that's a huge, that is the number one factor in whether or not you're going to end up being more likely to weather your adverse life events better.
The support network, having a strong support network where you can give as well as receive, it sounds
exactly,
like.
Exactly. And where you can let in, where you can express your needs and seek comfort and provide comfort. It's really kind of a reciprocal process, but yeah.
Oh, that's actually good to know, and that's something that people could learn as well. They can learn to be there for others in a very
Absolutely.
Genuine way,
yeah.
and they can learn how to be more vulnerable. That it's okay to be vulnerable and to allow others to help.
Yeah, so then, but the paradox, of course, for people who themselves have an avoidant attachment pattern, is very often they don't realize that it's this vulnerability that is going to be able to help them. And so that is one of the difficulties when, you know, and why it's very often why I see folks like this in therapy, because they come in because they're trying to cope and they're isolating themselves and they're drinking and they're trying to numb the pain rather than go through the pain. And that's tough. I mean, it's not like I can just say to them, okay, you just need to go through the pain. You know, it's a process. I've got to sort of sit with them and I've got to kind of meet them where they're at and kind of recognize that right now this is all they know. Like this coping method, maybe workaholism is one I see a fair bit. You know, this is maybe what they know, but it's not helping them. It's helping them in the short run, but in the long run, it's actually making them feel even more isolated.
Right. So let's go back to the topic of PTSD, if you don't mind.
Sure. Yeah, no problem.
So some people do develop PTSD, after their partner's affair, and sometimes they also develop trauma bonds to the cheating spouse. They feel like they're bound into a trauma bond with their spouse. Can you tell me a little bit more about these trauma bonds, why they occur and what they look like?
Well, okay, sure. But before I do that, let me just, because the issue of trauma and the affair, one thing to think about, yes, affairs are huge life events for many, many people. I think they represent loss in many ways, loss of how they, you know, what they imagined, what they hoped for in the relationship that they had imagined, when people are surprised by their partner's affair. And that it can feel very traumatic for many people. How they respond to it, though, is very much tied into their characteristic attachment pattern. So people who have had partners, have affairs, and then they're relatively securely attached. You know, they go into the relationship, into the marriage, or into the you know, committed relationship with secure attachment. They're it's easier for them to weather the shock of what happened. They're less likely to feel, oh, I'm a terrible person. I'm the cause of this. I can't ever get over this. I drove her away or drove him away. Those sorts of things with people who are securely attached, less likely to. People who have insecure attachment, they're going to, you know, the affair activates whatever attachment pattern you have. It's a kind of a loss. It's a kind of shock. It's an overwhelming event for many people. You know, the news of this, and it can, you know, the feelings can be really overwhelming. And so for those people who are feeling a sense of abandonment or rejection or loss, if you have an avoidant attachment pattern, those are really vulnerable feelings, and you are going to want to turn those feelings off. And so you might delve, you know, into substances, or you may, you know, go party. Because why? Because you don't want to think about it, or various other things. So it's just something to think about in terms of how do people respond to affair very differently. Different people respond really differently. Now to answer your question about trauma bonds, traumatic bonding, that's a special kind of case, and it is certainly a most unfortunate case. It's not a typical one, but it is one that some people have, and I've certainly seen it in therapy when I've worked with people. So what is traumatic bonding? Traumatic bonding is when people are in the midst of a relationship that's kind of abusive, and yet they feel connected to the person, they feel special to this person, they depend on this abusive person. It's a combination of two incompatible feelings, fear and love. You know, love shouldn't be frightening. You should not be afraid of someone who you love. But this is, in fact, what is the case with traumatic bonding. There's a sense of being afraid of this person, but being kind of, you know, being in love with them. And there's a sort of tendency to want to identify with them, or to give them lots of chances, to idealize them, you know, to pretend the relationship is much better than it is, more ideal than it really is. There's a kind of preoccupation with the person, and so yeah, I mean, these can, you know, like a, you know, these can be the case in relationships that are abusive, and it's certainly, you know, I see this in patterns where there's a person who you know, one person really devalues the other and goes and has affairs or goes and maybe even flaunts it in front of the other person's face kind of thing. And it's a very ugly and disturbing and self-destructive pattern. Did I answer your question?
Maybe. Yes, okay. You did. And I just had a quick follow-up on that. Are there instances where infidelity can indeed be abusive in the way it's used?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Can you describe a scenario?
Yeah, where the relationship is held hostage. You know, it's kind of like, you know, and the person is blamed, you know, the person is blamed for the other person's behavior. You know, well, you know, I'm doing this because you're causing me to, that sort of thing. The relationship can be held hostage. There's this one woman who I worked with a couple of years back who would come in every week telling me, you know, the shenanigans her partner was up to, and it was just awful. You know, at first I did, you know, very clearly give her some psychoeducation. You know, this is not love. He is being abusive. You know, I laid that out. But I very quickly realized that if I keep telling her to leave this guy, and I had this happen previously, the client is just going to leave me. You know, when people are traumatically bonded to somebody, they will protect the relationship, come hell or high water, and they would rather drop the therapist, who, even if the therapist is a very nice person who's telling them all the right things and telling them, you know, what you're doing is really self-destructive, they will much more quickly drop the therapist than drop their abusive partner. And so I was, you know, certainly listening to her, certainly, you know, working with her to sort of get her to explore her feelings, but it took a long time for her to reach a point, about a year, and this guy was having affairs on her left, right, and center. I mean, he would come to her, you know, she was basically, my client was basically kind of her booty call, and he was dating other people, and he was kind of chronically having affairs, and it was just devastating to my client. I mean, just terrible. They weren't technically married, but they were very much previously in a committed relationship. I mean, she was mothering this person's child, and it was certainly, for all intents and purposes, a highly committed. Previously, it had been a highly committed relationship, from her perspective, anyway. I don't know about him. Took about a year of work, and at some point we started really talking about her past, and this is somebody who had been seriously hurt in her earlier relationships. She was able to recognize this. She did in fact end the relationship with this guy, thank God. I was so relieved by this. But that was a process. I mean, we're together, we're apart, we're together, we're apart for months. She did eventually. And it wasn't just kind of because she thought it would make me happy. It was because she recognized, and I felt it was really authentic, that she really realized that this was just something that was just destroying her. And the other piece was she didn't want this to destroy her child. She had a daughter, and she wanted her daughter to grow up with a model of a mother who was able to value herself. And at some point she said, you know, is this the kind of woman I want her to be? I mean, I don't want this for her. And so she was able to harness a kind of strength in her. I mean, she found a strength in her. I mean, it was a lot of support from me, but there was something she found in herself. And I think it was for the sake of her daughter that she was able to do this initially, but then it became for herself as well. And in fact, she's doing much, much, much better now.
Oh, so. that's That's a great story, actually. Best case scenario.
Yeah. No, she's a and I'm very, very proud of her. Very proud.
Yes, and it reminds me of, I don't know how it is in Canada, but in the US, when talking about domestic violence, we found that a woman will leave her abusive partner and go back between 7 and 9 times before she makes that final break. So it's always a process. The first time never sticks.
I know. Yep. Nope. Same here in Canada. We have
Right.
similar demographic. Yeah, for sure. It's a very similar thing. And yeah, I mean, it just and that does hopefully provide hope for people who are going through this, so that they can say to themselves, you know, I don't have to have this figured out right away. It can be a process. But yeah, it takes a lot of fortitude, and especially when you feel dependent on somebody, and when you've convinced yourself that you love them and they love you, and you know they just need another chance and that sort of thing. It can be, you know, it can take a while to sort of realize kind of what you know, that this is not love, and also that you deserve better, right?
Right. And sometimes that's harder, though. If somebody's been married for 30 years, for example,
Oh yeah.
there's this negotiation time
Right.
when things happen.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. Oh, it's
And it
can be so challenging when the relationships are, you know, many years. Yeah.
and a lot, I'm finding that a lot of people actually want to stay together after the affair has run its process. But the issue is probably the biggest issue with recovery, one of the biggest ones, is how to manage triggers. Because after D-Day, after a betrayed spouse finds out they have been betrayed, they will look back and think of maybe a wedding anniversary, a son's birthday, a certain song, and they'll realize that all these things are associated with the other person in one way or another. So during recovery, they could hear that song on the radio and think, oh, that was apparently the song that my spouse had with the other person, and it will bring all of that pain back, feeling like they haven't made any progress at all. Do you have any advice on how to manage those triggers?
I do, but I will. But let me first just address the broader issue of recovery from affairs, and I think, because the triggers are sort of a specific case of it, so I promise to answer that. But let me just first, I'm a typical psychologist, answering a question with another indirectly. But let me say that, you know, how do you get over an affair, the mental health anguish caused by an affair? And I want to just make a couple points to this broader question. And the first point I want to make is that a lot of people rush to forgive, and it's really important in this day and age where we hear so much about forgiveness as being the ultimate thing that you should be doing. There's so many gurus out there, so many mental health and new age gurus preaching the idea of forgiveness. I'm not against forgiveness. Forgiveness is just fine, but it has to be arrived at naturally. And how do you arrive at it naturally? Well, if an affair happens and people are staying in the relationship, like, you know, the relationship has survived the affair, but the couple wants to kind of get over the pain and the hurt, and or the person who's you know, who's the sort of victim, so to speak, of the affair, or the one who's had, you know, had the you know, who's been hurt by the affair, you know, wants to somehow figure out, do I want to stay in this relationship? Well, the first question I ask is, was there an apology? Was there some taking responsibility for the actions? Is there remorse? Is there empathy? Is the person who has, you know, done the affair, so to speak, acted on the affair, is that person in some way aware of the hurt they've caused the other person? Is there some remorse? And I have an interesting couple who I worked with, and I'll be brief about this. I said this idea to one couple, and the woman was, so again, this is also a man and a woman, but I've also worked with affairs where it's the other way around, where the woman has an affair and the guy is really struggling and that sort of, but in this particular case, it's also the guy who had the affair and the woman is kind of struggling with the aftermath. And I had a meeting with him, and I said to him, you know, you haven't apologized. So next session, he sits down with her, and you know, he's determined he's going to apologize. And he sits down, and she sits down, and he looks at her, and he says to her, I'm sorry you were lied to. And she slams her hand down on the desk, gets up, walks out of the office, storms out, and slams the door shut. I didn't think I was going to see her again. She came back the following week, and we unpacked. What a crummy apology that was. It was such a lame apology. Why? Because he never actually took responsibility. I'm sorry you were lied to is such passive voice. And I said this is passive voice. And she said, you know what? Yeah, I knew it drove me nuts, that apology, but I didn't know why. Because he wasn't actively taking responsibility. There's no, I'm sorry that I hurt you. I'm sorry that my decisions actually led to you feeling a lot of pain. So there has to be this kind of, and this is an important piece. The second important piece that I want to say about getting over or moving past an affair is that an affair is a loss. And, you know, if people lose the relationship, okay, that's one thing. They've lost the relationship. But if they're trying to stay in the relationship, there's another important loss, and that is the loss of innocence. The relationship, you know, used to be kind of, in a sense, there used to be a certain innocence about it, a certain hopefulness about it. Well, when there's been an affair, very often, there's a sense of, oh, okay, my partner really has the capability of hurting me. And that's not necessarily a terrible realization. It's painful, but it can also be growthful. You know, if the person realizes, hey, okay, this is, and there's been apology, there's been working through, there's been some sort of, you know, dealing with the actual feelings, some empathy, you know, one toward the other, then it is possible, of course, to get over the loss that is represented by an affair, but there is kind of a loss of innocence about the relationship. Okay, so that's the broader idea about recovering from an affair. Do you want to ask me anything about that, or should I just move on to triggers? Is that
sure.
I'm happy to talk about triggers. I'm happy. It was just a very specific case.
Right. That is wonderful. Thank you so much for explaining that. That is awesome. But I did have one thing that I was keying in on, that fellow who didn't want to take responsibility,
right,
and was demonstrating that by using very passive voice. He could have been talking to anybody about anything, and
right,
it just wasn't an apology, as you said. Why don't people want to take responsibility? Why?
Well, okay, I mean, it's just, you know, I can't speak to it for everybody, but I mean, in this particular case, It's a very, very vulnerable thing to admit that there's a part of you that can really hurt somebody you love. And it's, you know, this is something that people don't want to admit. And people very often want to present themselves to themselves. It's kind of a willful blindness or a self-deception that people don't want to recognize that you know, we all have parts of us that hurt others, even those we love, even those we care about. And we all lose it in our relationships. We all say things that are stupid. We all say things that can be hurtful to our partners. You know, we don't all have affairs. I mean, some of us do, some of us don't. You know, I mean, I think that it's quite common. But I think recognizing that when we've done something that has really hurt our partner, that we have the capability of being quite cruel or quite insensitive or quite hurtful, that's a hard thing for people to recognize. It means recognizing a part of yourself that is not so, not so good. And you know, we all have parts of us that are that are, you know, that we'd rather not admit to, right?
Mm-hmm.
And some
I
of
know,
us
I've been
have
to...
maturity and can admit it. Some of us can't.
Right, right. And I've mentioned sometimes in blog posts that everybody more or less has a good internal narrative and that they always want to be cast as the good guy in mm-hmm. situations.
Yeah.
And so when they do something that is objectively so not good, it might be hard to reconcile that with the internal narrative.
Right.
Does that come into play at all?
Yeah, I fully agree. I mean, yeah, we all see ourselves as nobody wants to see themselves as average. We all see ourselves as better than average and kinder and this and that. And yeah, I mean, I think the internal narrative is a certain truth. I mean, there is a certain truth to our internal narrative, but there's also a certain pretense to it also. You know, we need to pretend to ourselves. We need to make ourselves feel better. We all cope in our own way. We all have defenses. But yeah, I mean, I think it can be, you know, I mean, after an affair, all of this stuff is just raging, all of these vulnerabilities and feelings about how we see ourselves, how we, you know, what we're able to admit to, you know, someone who's been cheated on also has to admit to some very painful things, and they need to ask themselves, well, you know, why did this happen? And you know, some people will blame themselves. Some people will, feel ashamed or humiliated. I mean, there are all kinds of feelings that people have that can be very self-destructive.
Mm. Yeah, thank you for explaining all of that. Now, sure. If we have time, let's circle back.
Want me to tell
to
about
this.
The triggers?
Yes.
Okay. So, I mean, for sure, I can say that absolutely, you know, people who have had losses such as an affair happen to them do have to deal with triggers. I would say the a couple of things around that. One is that it's really important not to beat yourself up for having feelings, for having bad feelings, yucky feelings. Sadness is something that, I mean, you know, certainly immediately after a partner has an affair, there's shock. But after, you know, once there's been some time and all, you know, the more the initial shock of it is over, there can be a real sadness that comes in and a sense of self-reproach or a sense of, you know, why did this happen? You know, so questioning oneself. A loss, again, there's a loss of innocence about your relationship. Oh, okay, this can happen to me too. And there's a real sadness that goes with that. It's really important not to beat yourself up about feeling sad. Around anniversaries and things like that, a year since you found out about it or a year since you got back together and then you remember the affair or whatnot, it's really important to predict that you're going to feel sad. Predict that you're going to have feelings about it. Now, if you happen to be someone who does feel sad, okay. But maybe you'll feel mad. Maybe you'll feel something else. Maybe you'll feel angry. Maybe you'll feel, sadness does not equal depression. It's okay to feel sad. Predict that you're going to have difficult time with anniversaries. I find that journaling really helps as well. I mean, I ask people always, you know, around anniversaries especially, journal about... if the relationship is over and you're struggling getting over the relationship, it's important to journal about the bad parts about the relationship, but it's also important to journal about the good parts because that's a lot of what you're struggling with is the loss. Most relationships, I mean, if it's a traumatic bonding kind of thing with somebody abusive, okay, that's quite terrible and it's often hard to find, you know, the good aspects of that, but most relationships are much grayer than that. It's not black and white in most relationships. And in almost all relationships, there are bad aspects and there are good aspects. And it's really important to mourn the loss of the good aspects. And finally, it's really important to use your friendships. So, you know, I've mentioned that before. You know, people often forget, and people often say, you know, I'm being such a drag, and I, you know, but if you've had a friend who you've talked with about something like this, like an affair, and it's coming up on the anniversary, or if it's been 5 years, and you're noticing that you're having difficulty. This is what friends do, you know, and be there for your friend too. You know, don't just use your friendship in a one-way kind of way. Be available to your friend, but also allow your friend in, right? I mean, be willing to seek friendships. It's very important. So those are, I think, the main ways that I would say, you know, that I recommend people manage triggers around these kinds of things.
What about the unpredictable triggers? For example, in today's day and age, when an affair is found out, a woman or a man might find a way into their partner's email account, and they might see thousands of emails that have transpired, and so they'll learn so much about the affair, so much about the other person, you know, what days the husband or wife was where.
Okay.
So they'll be triggered.
So that's pretty early in the event, in the sense that you're still kind of in the middle of the trauma. So one thing in trauma theory that's really important is that you can't really recover from the trauma until the trauma is over. So when you're in the middle of it, like when you're still in the throes of the pain, and there's more pain and still more pain and still more pain, you're in the middle of the traumatic event. And this is true, you know, if the traumatic event is a long, drawn-out death, like as in a parent who's got a horrible, debilitating disease that takes, you know, years, you're still in the middle of the trauma. So when people come to me and say, I want to help dealing with this, I say to them, well, you're right in the throes of a crisis. Like, let's manage how you're feeling right now, but I can't help you quite get over this yet. I mean, it's not even over. And so that's true in the situation you're talking about as well. If you're still finding out about emails, like, you know, your partner said, well, this is what happened, and they gave you some tiny little story, and it's like way more, you're still dealing with loss and trauma, and you're getting hurt and hurt again. And so how to deal with that? Well, I mean, I would say recognizing that you're going to have up and down feelings. I mean, this is going to be, you're in the middle of finding out, of being disillusioned, of finding things out, and you don't really know, you know, you don't know the lay of the land yet. You don't know what the damage is just yet. And so I would say don't try to, quote, get over it yet. It's not over. You're still in the middle. And why is that helpful? Because it helps people sort of from having to put pressure on themselves to, quote, get over it already. You know, give yourself permission to be in pain. You're in pain because you're finding things out that are painful, and you're getting disillusioned, and it's really sad. And recognize that. That doesn't mean you'll be in pain forever. The pain, at some point, you will know what the sort of damage is, so to speak. So, you know, the shock will be over. You will find, okay, all right, this is what happened. Now, it does sometimes happen that even years later people discover things, and of course that can be. But, you know, the kind of fundamental disillusionment, like, oh my God, wow, this really was way worse than I imagined. Oh my God. That kind of feeling, people do at some point get over that, and then it becomes a feeling from the past, and then it's like, okay, this happened and I found out about it, and you know, it's been about 6 months since I really knew the whole story, and now I really am ready to kind of try to get over this, that kind of thing.
And here's a follow-up question though. So you can't unsee all those emails that you've read. So let's say that your husband, for example, cut off the affair, and it's 3 years later since he cut off the affair, but you have the knowledge that he and the other woman shared some favorite songs once again, or did some certain things or ate at some certain places for dinner or stayed at certain hotels, even worse. And let's say that song comes on the radio. And even though you're 3 years out, some women are still actually triggered by that.
Absolutely. And then I would say, you know, then I would ask, what else is going on in your relationship? I mean, if you really, you know, two scenarios, that exact same scenario you talked about, if the guy has taken responsibility, expressed remorse, you two have sat through a whole process of really, you know, recognizing why did this happen and how can things be different and what was it that each of us, what were the contributions each of us made to lead to our relationship being in this way, and what was the way in which, the person who had the affair was really insensitive to the other person or that kind of thing, and you've really kind of worked that through. It's going to feel very different hearing that song on the radio. I mean, that's going to be more of an irritant than traumatic. On the other hand, if there has been no working through, you know, you've just kind of, put a Band-Aid on it, and then absolutely, you know, anytime those triggers are going to be huge triggers. So the actual trigger itself is going to have power depending on what's actually happened in the relationship to work through the affair and the feelings as a result of the affair. So that's what I would say is the kind of the thing that I would really look at there, you know, if I was working with a couple in therapy. You know, if you have done that working through and the song comes on the radio, give yourself permission to hate that song. I mean, maybe you're just going to hate that song for the rest of your life. And you're going to hate it, and it's going to be annoying. Again, if you've done the work that I mentioned about working through the hurts in the relationship. So that's what I would say. That's what I would say is the big piece here.
A trigger in that sense can almost be used as a barometer to figure out where you are, or a thermometer. It gives feedback.
If you're getting triggered.
How far have we come? Right?
Exactly. Yep.
Well, and that might be a good way to reframe it, because instead of seeing a trigger as something scary, it now becomes something that can tell you and inform you where you're at and maybe point you towards some things that still need to be solved.
Absolutely. It's also, though, true that triggers connect you to prior traumas. So, you know, the trauma of an affair, or the trauma, you know, if a person experiences an affair, because not everybody experiences an affair as a trauma, remember, you know, people respond to the same event very differently. But if you experience an affair as a trauma, these triggers can be, yes, they can be barometers for it, but they also might connect to earlier traumatic events. So if you've had violations of trust earlier in your life, that also may really come up as a result of feeling the loss of trust due to an affair. So it may be that the song or the trigger is a sign that you haven't worked things through in your relationship. But it also may be a sign that you haven't worked something else through. So just to be fair, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily assume. I mean, sometimes, see, the thing is that the same emotional theme can be triggered by a later event, you know. So, you know, if you've had your trust violated, you may really be very, you may be triggered by an affair because you've had some real serious violations of trust earlier on.
How do people connect those? Because I don't think that would be obvious to most people.
Well, you're right. It wouldn't be. I do work with people in therapy to help them look at emotional themes. I often ask clients, what role has fill in the blank emotion, played in your life. So, you know, I might say to them, what role has, so like, you know, they find that, let's say, let's an example, that they're triggered by a song and they're feeling really angry. I might say, Karen, tell me what role, what I want to understand better your relationship with anger. What role has anger played in your life? I want to hear about the moments in your life that you really felt the angriest. And so we look at some themes of how this emotion ties together across different moments in their lifespan. Or what role has abandonment played in your life? This person feels really abandoned, you know. And so we connect, and that helps, you know, take a feeling and connect different situations across your life to that feeling. You might even really, you know, in journaling, you might sort of take the feeling that's really kind of coming up when you're getting triggered and just say to yourself, okay, I'm going to think about when I was a kid. I'm going to think about when I was a teenager. I'm going to think about when I was a young adult. You know, walk through different times in your development, or walk through different relationships you've had. You know, my relationship with Kyle, my relationship with Henry, my relationship with Joe, and ask yourself, when did that emotion really come up in each of those phases of your development or in phases of your relational life? And that's a nice way to tie together, you know, a theme that comes up, your way of dealing with certain feelings. It can help with kind of bringing some insight around the meaning that different emotions have for you uniquely.
Okay. That is actually great. That's a great idea and a great concept. And I don't, as I said, I don't think that's obvious for most people straight off the bat.
Yeah.
They may think that they're thinking about one thing and one event, but they don't realize that this is the tip of the iceberg and there's actually a mountain of pain underneath it that they're not connecting.
Yeah. That's true, yeah.
Oh, is there anything else that you'd like to say before we conclude this interview? I don't want to take up too much of your time. You've been extremely generous. Is there anything that you would like to say to our subscribers about any of these topics, getting over trauma, affair recovery? Are there some hopeful words that you could possibly give them?
I mean, around the trauma bond idea, I would say, you know, traumatic bonding, I would say, if you're feeling scared or powerless in a relationship, something's wrong. So that's something to really think about. If you're feeling chronically scared and powerless, it's a real sign of concern. You know, you do want to really think about your safety. You want to think about your children's safety. You want to think about, you know, if you're living in a home where you're feeling unsafe, that's a really awful way to live. And ultimately, if it's been like that for a long time, you know, there's reason to be skeptical that it's going to get much better, you know, if it's on its own. And so that's something to really think about. Otherwise, I feel like I've, you know, shared some of how I like to think about folks who I've worked with and trauma and PTSD and avoidant attachment and how people recover from losses such as the painful loss that goes with having you know, with being on the receiving end of an affair. So yeah, I mean, I really appreciate the chance to have spoken with you, Sarah.
Yes, and I really appreciate you sharing all of your information with us. It's absolutely wonderful, and I know that so many people will be helped, and that's the goal. So thank you.
You're welcome. Fantastic.
Yeah. Well, we will be in touch soon, and you will hear from me over email.
Okay, great.
Yeah, thanks again. Have a
You're
great
very
day.
Welcome. Okay, take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.